morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Judge Santel, Judge Rogers, good to see you again. Judge Kavanaugh, nice to meet you. Steve LaCar for appellants, and I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The best question the government posed in a Batson claim is, why would we discriminate? And there's an answer to that. I'm going to give you my theory. Our theory is, to use a colloquialism, a word that I'll return to later, that death drove this train. That if you're an African American who was on the fence as to race, as to the death penalty, you didn't get the benefit of a doubt. Whereas if you were a white who was on the fence, you did get the benefit of a doubt. The record reflects persistent episodes of disparate treatment, of distortion of the records, and of new excuses. We identify those in a brief. I'm going to highlight just a few of them today in the limited time that I have available. The judge's findings, unfortunately, as a case cited by both parties, Green versus Lamarck, says, they're very cryptic, as a one sentence fits all at the very conclusion of a 2.5 hour hearing, where the district judge below said, I find the prosecutor's reasons to be credible, and that's all he said. I want to make this very clear. If you hear nothing else from me, I'm a fervent admirer of a district judge, but he didn't get this one right. I talked about unexplained treatment by the prosecutors of African Americans versus whites. 4730, a management officer. They told the district judge that she was, quote, against law enforcement. They didn't give Judge Lamberth any explanation. Today they come forth and they say to you, well, she had concerns with DNA.
What was the ultimate composition of the jury ethnically, counsel?
As the government points out, the ultimate composition of the main veneer was 9-3.
Nine and three blacks to white.
That's correct. And I'm chagrined to tell you, Your Honor, I don't remember what the
Forget about the alternates and just take the main jury, okay? Thank you, counsel.
But what's more important is that the strike, two things, that the strike rate was 5-1 and that Judge Lamberth found there was a prima facie case of race discrimination.
Didn't he say assuming there's a prima facie case?
Sir?
Didn't he say assuming there's a prima facie?
I thought he found a prima facie case.
I confess I've not memorized the entire record in this case. But
and me too.
I didn't carry in the entire record in this case. But I was thinking he said assuming there's a prima facie case.
Well, I think we all can all agree that the strike rate is certainly significant, and not necessarily statistically significant, but the strike rate is a factor the courts have pointed to. So I talked about 4730. Today they said, the death penalty didn't apply in D.C. That was something she thought. Judge Lamberth corrected her and said, well, ma'am, the death penalty does apply in federal court. Same problem that two whites had, and they were seated, she wasn't. 5773.
Was there a comment about rogue police for 47?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Wasn't there a comment about rogue police from 4730?
I think what she said is to rogue police that there were some police officers who were prone to violate the law, but there were also whites who said the same thing. You can't generalize. You just can't generalize. 5773, the environmental researcher. He said, according to the government, he said he was somewhat opposed on religious grounds to the death penalty. Well, there was one white they seated, 6487, who said he was generally opposed to the death penalty. And what he said was, at voir dire, he said his real concern with the death penalty was that innocents had been put to death or could be put to death. There were four whites who said the same thing. We've identified them in the record. There were outright distortions.
Evidently, they didn't all make it to the jury.
That's right. But remember something, Your Honor. Under Batson and its jurisprudence, a strike of one that's animated by race discrimination is structural error.
I'm suggesting when you say there were four whites that said the same thing.
Oh, they did. They were seated. I'm sorry.
You said earlier there were only three whites on the venari.
Oh, I'm including 6487, the alternate. He was an alternate.
Okay, I thought we were leaving the alternates off, Judge.
Well, I think you have to look at the totality of circumstances, Your Honor. If I misunderstood you, I apologize.
Well, I thought I misunderstood you, I guess.
I think I'm to blame, and I want to...
Go ahead, Johnson.
Millerell makes it quite clear, as does Snyder, but we have to look to the totality of the circumstances, and I don't think we can afford to overlook 6487, because not only was he generally opposed to the death penalty, he was a person who had been sued by the FEC, Federal Election Commission. He had a brother who had been arrested and put in diversion for drug distribution, and he had a nephew who had been sent away for drug distribution. And yet, he was seated. There were African Americans. There was an African American who was a judge under the plain error standard, 866. She had a nephew who'd been involved in a domestic dispute in North Carolina, killed his wife, tried to kill himself, and they didn't seat her. And they said their position as to her was that today, well, she
that's
has
a plain error, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Nobody even objected to that.
That's correct.
I wonder when you got the cold record and hunted it out that you came up with that.
Well, as to plain error, Your Honor, I want to also add this, as we said in our brief. That doesn't preclude the court from assessing it, particularly where we
How many defense attorneys were there at trial?
I believe there were two for each defendant. Yeah. That would make 10, isn't that correct?
10 defense attorneys, some of them some of the top criminal lawyers in the Washington Bar, and none of them even objected to that strike at trial.
Your Honor, this was a 2.5-hour hearing in which they went through 34 jurors. That's about 5.5 minutes per juror. It's pretty hard to remember. On the day 36, there were 35 days of voir dire, so it's kind of hard for people to look back and remember everything. But the fact of the matter is, as Deborah Brown tells us, case out of the Second Circuit, it wasn't a deliberate attempt not to raise the issue. They certainly identified plenty of other bats and concerns. I want to talk very briefly about new excuses that have surfaced today, something that I suggest reeks of afterthought, if I can borrow from Miller L. 4730, the management officer. Her husband was an officer, a high-ranking officer in a former administration. Today we're told, for the first time in their appellate brief, that the prosecutors had concerns because her husband's car had been banged by a Secret Service officer. Well, the fact of the matter is that the Secret Service ended up apologizing to her husband. And there's a case called McLean versus Prunty out of the Ninth Circuit that says under those circumstances, one would assume that a juror is fair, particularly where she said that didn't affect her.
Problem you have with comments like that, one would assume, your burden is not met by saying somebody else might not have exercised this track. The burden you have to overcome is establishing that the government acted from a racial motive. It's not a question whether it was a wise strike.
That's right.
Or a universally applauded strike.
That's right.
I'm sure you and I could take the same venari, trying cases and sit down, we'd come up with a different result on who we'd strike.
And I don't have any doubt.
When you say something about one would assume, one other one might not assume.
Okay, but here's the problem. Who was the person to make that decision, Your Honor? That would have been the district
prosecutor.
The district
and you, and it's you that has to establish they did it on a racial basis.
Sir?
It's you that has to establish that they did it on a racial
I
basis.
I think we set forth.
And for these, you have to establish that by a plain error standard.
That's.
And a comment like one would assume, even you're quoting a case, that doesn't get you very far on that standard.
Perhaps not as to the plain error, but we certainly get pretty far on the ones that were challenged, Your Honor, such as 2932, where today they say, well, they were concerned because she said some police officers were human. Well, there were white people. One said you can't generalize about police officers who were seated. Or 5773.
Which one were you just talking about, 2932?
2932.
Right, 2932 was concerned about the delay, right?
And also, as were whites. Whites said
right, and also comments about excessive force by police.
What she said was two things. I'll first address delay. Right. She said she was concerned with delay, but she didn't say she'd hold it against the prosecution. Nobody ever questioned her about that. That's certainly a factor in the Batson jurisprudence. They were really concerned about that. Why didn't they question her? Mm-hmm. The other one, rogue police officer, I'm sorry, but she had some concerns about excessive force.
Yeah.
What she said, Your Honor, was that she was concerned with a report that some agencies had engaged in excessive force. She didn't say it across the board. She didn't make that across the board statement. And it is a fact, unrebutted by the government, that the newspapers had reported plenty of instances of brutality by the PG County Police, and there was a memorandum of understanding between the Department of Justice and the District of Columbia MPD about excessive force. This woman's, I'm sure you've read her jury questionnaire, she was a regular reader of the papers and a regular watcher of TV. This was the woman who Judge Lambert agreed was close to an ideal juror.
Your argument here brings up two, to pick up on what Chief Judge Sentelle was saying, two broader points or issues I have. One is the Supreme Court's emphasized the role of the trial court, even in reversing in Snyder. Absent exceptional circumstances, we would defer to the trial court. Trial court has a pivotal role. So our standard here is highly deferential, a lot of the arguments you're making, I think, at the district court level.
You defer whether there are findings that are supported by the record. There are no findings.
So that's issue one. And then issue two, contextually, you look at Batson, you look at Miller L., you look at Snyder, the facts are a long way in terms of the context from here. All four African Americans in Batson, 9 of the 10. In Miller L., it comes from Dallas, 1985, which had a policy at the time and was one of the motivations behind the Batson decision to begin with, was that policy in Dallas. That's a long way from a jury that has 9 of 12 African Americans. So those two points together make me concerned about your submission.
Let me try to help you with that, Your Honor. Let's look at Green versus Lamarck. That's a case both sides cite and rely on heavily. That's a case where they reversed and grant on a habeas, where there's even a tougher standard. In Green versus Lamarck, what they said was there's no presumption that the trial judge really credited the record one way or another because he didn't explain. In fact, in the Supreme Court case that they just cited, they brought the 28J to your attention. If one reads the California appellate decision, it is quite clear that the trial judge engaged in some sort of reasoned analysis on the record. We don't have that here. What we have is a number of instances of new excuses, distortions of the record, and findings, challenges of demeanor. For you to prevail,
we have to conclude that the record shows that the prosecutor was lying and that the prosecutor was, in fact, motivated by race. That's a very hard thing to do on paper. Who's well situated to determine that, judge the demeanor, as the Supreme Court has said, is the district judge.
But there was no finding as to demeanor. Let's talk about 3872.
Nobody says there has to be a finding as to the prosecutor's demeanor.
I don't agree with you, Your Honor. I think I suggest to you, look at Hardcastle, Third Circuit.
I don't care much if you agree with me, actually.
I do. I hate
prosecutor, the district judge is in a better position to judge demeanor than we are. And when we're talking about credibility, demeanor is inherently involved. And that's the way it is. I mean, trial judges actually see what's going on. We've got a cold record. And for us to disturb that demeanor is automatically a factor. I don't see why we need a finding as to demeanor. We don't need a finding that the world is round. I mean, there are some things that are inherent, and that's one of them, it would seem.
Well, no question you can take judicial notice that the world is round, but one can't take judicial notice on a cold record. The record certainly doesn't prove their case any more than it disproves ours, but I don't think the court can feel very comfortable, like with 3872, where they have a series of excuses that shift that weren't made below, and the judge didn't discuss.
And certainly agree that one racially motivated strike is error.
I realize
and certainly applaud that one racially motivated strike is error. But when the prosecution knows from the beginning, or apparently does, that they're going to wind up with a jury approximating 9-3 black to white, you've got an awful hill to climb to have us decide that the judge committed error, let alone plain error, in accepting the explanation of the prosecutor.
That's certainly the point they made, but here's the problem of the point they made, is look back at Miller L. When you know you're going to have African Americans on the jury, when you know that's going to happen, and you want to keep off people who, as we say, were on the fence, what you've got to do is...
Well, you want to keep off people who were on the fence.
African Americans, if you want to give the whites the benefit of a doubt, that's what our theory is. That's what happened here. Now, you talked about demeanor. I've got one in my remaining minute. I'm going to eat up some of my time. I'm going to refer you to three cases. I'm going to refer you to Hardcastle. That's a Third Circuit case. I'm going to refer you to Riley.
368 F3rd 246, Hardcastle.
I don't remember the site. I just remember the case name. That was a habeas case, Your Honor, and they reversed on a demeanor. Also, Riley. You might take a look at Green versus Lamarck, Snyder. And there was a case I read last night for the first time, U.S. v. Joe out of the Fourth Circuit, 928 Fed Second 99. It's a 1991 Fourth Circuit case, 928 Fed Second 99. And they urge trial judges to make findings on the record. What you have in terms of credibility, you have an Anderson versus Bessemer City case here. There are distortions of the record. How can anybody be sure?
Anderson versus Bessemer City.
It's a Title VII case.
I know. I was there. It's a Title VII case in which the appellate court reversed the district judge, and the Supreme Court put it back, saying you owe all kind of credibility deference to the district judge. If there's a case out there that cuts against you, it's...
No, but it has a passage in there. It says sometimes credibility, the record can refute credibility. There are things like objective fact, the world is round. You can't...
Okay, that was a spare dicta, because Anderson versus Bessemer City, the Fourth Circuit had said that the record essentially did refute credibility. Right. And the United States Supreme Court said, look, the district judge is there. Even if it's only a paper evidence, he's still in a better position to judge facts than the appellate court. If there is a case that cuts against you, I wouldn't go get a Title VII case that went the other way and try to side it, counsel.
That's right. But Judge Santel...
I wasn't in the case, but I happened to have been there both at the trial and at the Fourth Circuit argument.
I assure you, in response to that, Your Honor, if this case were coming up on a Title VII context with a bench trial, these sort of findings, an ipsy dixit that the plaintiff was credible, I submit to the court that you would reverse summarily, which is what the law...
There was no finding in Anderson of credibility. It was simply findings that inherently incorporated the credibility of the witnesses.
Well, I'll be guided by that, but here there's just simply an ipsy dixit, one sentence, one size fits all.
Counsel, we've talked you past your time. I apologize for that, but your time is up. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll start to say we'll see you again, but I guess that's your issue, so we won't see you again up there.
You'll see a lot of me, Your Honor. May it please the court, Leslie Androdo on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start out with the standard of review, which the court has already touched on, but the standard here is very deferential. In order to prevail on this Batson claim in this appeal, appellants would need to establish that the district court clearly erred in crediting the prosecutor's race-neutral justifications for the strikes.
I thought their argument was a little more sophisticated, namely that there are three parts to Batson and that the district court didn't fulfill his obligations under the third part.
That is a portion of their argument, and our position is that we disagree with that. The district court here, first of all, the court's finding was a specific finding crediting the prosecutor's race-neutral justifications for its strikes. While the court didn't articulate a finding as to each strike individually, there's nothing that says that that's required. I think when one goes back and reads the transcript of the Batson colloquy, it's very apparent that the court was very engaged with the parties during the colloquy. As counsel indicated, it was, I believe he said, 2.5-hour proceeding. The court interacted with the parties. The court apparently had its own notes and consulted them and referred to the fact that that he was consulting them during the proceeding. So it's clear here that the court had a very thorough exploration of the issues and a thorough understanding of them, and on that basis made a finding of credibility, ultimately, which is what the court is required to do. So we believe that the...
What do you understand the third prong of Batson to require?
Well, the third prong is that the court has to look at the race-neutral justifications that were offered by the prosecutor. The defense has to show that those race-neutral justifications are pretextual in order to prevail.
Well, the argument here is that whites got a break.
That's their argument. That's portion of their argument. In fairness, they actually have, there are two portions to their argument.
Well, I've read the transcript, and they brought this to the district court's attention.
They did not make the comparative juror analysis that they're making in this appeal.
They certainly pointed to whites who had similar...
In one point, one defense attorney in a very general way referenced it, but didn't make the specific comparisons here. And I would like to point something out to the court factually that I think is very important in assessing whether the district court's finding could survive clear.
I mean, counsel, that's just not a correct statement of the record. Defense counsel did point and gave the number of white jurors who had similar views. That doesn't necessarily mean your argument isn't going to prevail, but let's be clear about what the record shows.
There, Your Honor, my understanding is that on a vast number of these, there may have been one or two, and there were some, there was a general statement,
well,
I may think.
It was done on juror 5773, it was done on juror 5698, it was done on juror 4463, It was done on juror 4730. It was done on juror 3872.
But I
it was done on juror 3559, just to cite some. So let's be clear, the issue was raised to the district court.
One thing I would point out to the court factually, that several of the jurors that appellants rely on to make this comparative juror analysis, they reply repeatedly on juror 6487. That's a big piece of this. And another one of the jurors is 3485. Immediately before the Batson colloquy, defense counsel put on the record that if they had had additional strikes available to them, because that was one of their claims, is they were entitled to additional peremptories, that they would have struck 6487 and specifically described that juror as predisposed towards guilt. They also indicated they would have struck juror 3845 because they felt that juror had a problem with presumption of innocence. Both of those issues go to really the sort of first stage, which is finding guilt. When appellants come in now and say that the prosecutor somehow gave those jurors a pass on the death penalty issue compared to what they claim were similarly situated black jurors, they're completely ignoring that they themselves, immediately before the colloquy, which the district court heard, they themselves told the district court, we think these jurors are favorable to the government. So how the court could have clearly erred in not picking up on this comparative juror analysis at that point, as to those jurors, I think it's just a really hard hurdle for appellants at this point to overcome. And I think similarly, the other white jurors that appellants point to, when one goes back and looks at their particular juror questionnaires and their voir dire, each of those jurors showed characteristics that were favorable to the government in some respects, the points on which appellants claim they were comparable truly aren't comparable and truly aren't similar. So
as you read the Supreme Court, under the third prong, what rule are you adopting?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that it's the defendant's burden to show to the district court that the prosecutor's race-neutral justifications were pretextual, and the court here found that the defendant had not met that burden. So this court's job is to determine whether the district court clearly erred in making that determination. And I don't think appellants have satisfied that.
Let's go to the content of what the third prong requires. That's what I'm trying to understand from the government's perspective. Certainly when you read the Supreme Court cases, they go over this sentence by sentence, line by line.
If I'm understanding Your Honor's question, what the court requires...
Defense counsel says, in response to the prosecutor's statement, but look, they agreed to these white jurors. All right. And then the prosecutor responds again. Does the judge have to make any finding whatsoever?
I don't believe the judge has to make specific findings as to each juror, as I said earlier, because ultimately what the issue is the prosecutor's credibility.
I'm just asking where this theme is repeated.
I think only if there's, again, Your Honor, it is difficult to remember the entire record. I do recall that there were things, as I said earlier, it was made, in my view, in a general way. I don't think the issue of comparative juror analysis was laid out during the voir dire anywhere near the way, or during the Batson colloquy, I'm sorry, anywhere near the way it's been done in these briefs. So I don't think one can fault the district court for not pulling out specifics in the way that we've done now on appeal after having had months and months and months to analyze the record. I think what the court did do was assess the prosecutor's credibility. A lot of the justifications that the prosecutor advanced, I think, would have been apparent to the court. Again, the court was consulting its own notes. The cases do make it clear that the prosecutor's credibility is probably the most important part of resolving a Batson challenge. And one of the things that happened here is there were a number of justifications that the prosecutor advanced that the defendants attempted to rebut, made statements, well, we don't recall that, or the juror didn't say that. And the prosecutor, as a team, they consulted, they went back, looked at the record, and came up and said, you know, Your Honor, here's where the juror said it. Here's the question in the questionnaire. And I think the fact that the prosecution team has such a command of the record and was able to show that to the district court goes a long way to showing credibility, which is exactly what the district court was assessing.
So So the rule would be that where the district court allows the prosecutor to respond and then allows defense counsel to respond and then allows the prosecutor to respond to the defense counsel and then makes a statement, I believe the prosecutor, that is all that is required under the third prong of Batson.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
That wouldn't mean that the court couldn't, we couldn't determine that the district court clearly erred in making that finding.
You could
you're simply saying that statement is, that finding is sufficient, not that it's unreviewable.
Well, I think we were talking about procedure. I think that's what the court is required to do, but it's certainly reviewable.
That's what I'm saying. We're only talking about procedure, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in a moment ago...
And if it were totally inconsistent with the record...
Right. And a moment ago, what I was going to offer to the court was in making a determination of clear error, it's very clear from all of the jurisprudence in this area that it's a totality of the circumstances. The court has to look at all of the factors that weigh in. And I believe here, again, the prosecutor's credibility is described as being chief among them. But there's really nothing else in this record that suggests that there was intentional discrimination. As the court indicated earlier, the composition of the veneer was such that, you know, appellants try to make a statistical argument and say, well, the government used 91% of its strikes against African-American jurors. Well, the pool was predominantly African-American, so it would make sense that a higher number of strikes would be used.
I believe the judge did find a prima facie case.
The judge said assuming a prima facie case.
That's what I thought.
I thought he said, at any rate, he found that there was not a prima facie case
as to gender.
African-American women.
Right.
Gender.
All right. But
then he said assuming
a prima facie case. But even if the court found a prima facie case, the strength of that prima facie case is something the court can consider. And here we believe it was actually not particularly strong. There was nothing else about the case, none of the kind of characteristics that you see, for example, in Miller L.
I just ask you, in a hypothetical, juror number one, who is a white male, says, I am opposed to the death penalty. He is seated. Juror number two is an African-American male who says, I have doubts. He is struck. Any Batson problem?
I don't think that would withstand clear error review, and I would point the court to the recent decision from the Supreme Court, which we provided in the 28J letter, Faulkner v. Jackson.
It doesn't tell us too much.
Well, but it does emphasize that this is a high standard. I mean, you have to show clear error.
That was a habeas case, though. Yes. I don't think you can read that outside the context of AEDPA.
They do reference, though.
They just reiterate
the standard. And the standard is a high standard. I think there would have to be more. I mean, you'd have to look at many other factors in the case to try to say that that's a pretextual strike.
It would at least go a long way toward establishing at least a prima facie case. Now,
whether it would withstand the defendant's burden, because it's the defendant's burden of showing pretext, I don't think that alone would be sufficient. I would address individual jurors if the court would like. Otherwise, we would submit with the on our brief on this issue and ask that the district court be affirmed.
Either of you wish to inquire as to specific? Seeing none, then, thank you, counsel, and we'll move on. Is there any time left for rebuttal?
There is no time left.
All right, we'll give him back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I was going to ask for that, and I'm very grateful. Your Honor, what they're asking the court to do, what they're asking you to do, is to assume that the district court below considered all the factors presented by the parties. There's nothing in the record to show that. Let me give you an analogy.
Counsel, in fairness, the district court presided at this hearing.
That's right.
He asked questions.
That's right.
He gave both sides an opportunity to make their arguments. So, I mean, we do have a record. He was there. He was engaged.
If memory serves me correctly, there was no specific discussion of individual jurors. It was ping pong.
I agree, but he heard what counsel had to say on both sides.
Well,
you just said there's no record of anything, and I just think that's overstating it. That's all I'm getting at.
There is no record of an engaged discussion. There's no record of an engaged discussion as to the individual jurors. This wasn't an individual. Let me give you an analogy, Your Honor. You met somebody for 5 minutes in the real world, a juror, 2 months ago. Do you remember much about what that juror, unless the juror was wearing something really flamboyant?
Suppose you had a detailed questionnaire from that person that you had had in your hand for some time. Your analogy is far from perfect, counsel, and I think you know it. That you had a detailed jury questionnaire on each of these people, right?
That's right, but there's...
So you had something to nail your memory to. It's not like meeting somebody at a cocktail party.
Judge, 2.5 hours...
Some jurors I questioned 30 years ago when I was picking juries.
I would suspect you do have superhuman recollection, but
I don't think that's superhuman. I think I was a trial lawyer.
I submit.
Maybe trial lawyers are superhuman, but most people don't think so.
I think the reality, in reality, it would be very difficult for somebody to remember what happened sometime back. But as to the notes, there's no record of an engaged discussion, no record of an appraisal of the individual jurors and whether the prosecutor, as to that juror, was credible or not. It was a one-size-fits-all. If you're comfortable with that, there's nothing I can do to persuade you otherwise. I regret that. But I think I would feel no small degree of discomfiture with this kind of a record, with a one-size-fits-all decision that the prosecutor is credible. 34 instances, 5 minutes per juror, 2.5-hour hearing.
Thank you, counsel. We'll move to the next issue.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Zwirling.
I'm John Zwirling, and I'm here representing Lionel Nunn. And I'd like to discuss the admission of the evidence of the Webster-Nunn conspiracy, which was indicted in 2000, and Mr. Nunn and pled guilty to a money laundering count, and the drug count was dismissed. But the evidence in that case consisted of all of the drugs and money found in his home during a search. We had the jeweler who had the videotaped conversations about money counting machines. We had a history of drug dealings between Webster and Nunn, where she primarily was the supplier and he the customer. And most of that, actually all of the evidence regarding the distribution from her to him ended months before Lionel Nunn ever met Kevin Gray or is alleged to have had anything to do with the Gray-Moore conspiracy. So really the first thing that the court has to decide is whether that conspiracy...
Let me ask you just a little bit beyond what you've already said. You're, by focusing on the Webster-Nunn, you're not abandoning the reliance in the brief on the Ruthel Edmond testimony.
We're not abandoning anything. I'm just want to get into the 404B issue right now for oral argument's sake. We don't have time for everything.
I understood you to be rising to issue of evidence of uncharged conspiracy.
Yes, sir.
And issue 5, Roman 5 in the brief, as I think rather more, at least as much about the Ruthel Edmond conspiracy at Webster-Nunn.
Well, for the oral argument, I had planned and prepared to focus on my client's.
All right, let me ask you a question. The district court gave a limiting instruction as to the Edmond testimony, did he not?
I believe so.
And did the Nunn-Webster testimony follow the Edmond testimony?
It was the end of the case, as I recall.
I'm trying to look at this from the perspective of the juror. The district court gives an instruction about the nature of the evidence that the jury's about to hear.
But
then it hears 2 days of Ruthel Edmond. And I'm just trying to find out.
Judge, I can get you the days that occurred. But my recollection is that Webster was a late witness. What happened in 99 and the end of the very end of 98 was the latter part of the case. And really, Mr. Nunn's name didn't come up at all for months and months and months in the beginning of the case. Of course, none of the defense counsel were in the case that many years ago. We got in subsequent, which is probably why it's taken so long to get this to your honors. But if I could...
I'm sure that's not the only reason.
What I would like to do, Your Honor, is deal with the specific issue of the Webster Nunn, because I think if I'm correct about that, we should get a new trial. Now, the first thing I would say is the court needs to determine whether it was one conspiracy or two conspiracies. I think the government has conceded it's two conspiracies. Ms. Jeffress so conceded at the trial level. So you have two conspiracies which they say are overlapping in time. Well, that's probably true. I'm sure that there are many conspiracies involving drugs in the District of Columbia that occurred in the 90s. But it doesn't make them one conspiracy. And the only connection between the two conspiracies that we were able to determine is that Lionel Nunn, in 99, or the very end of 98, is alleged to have joined with Mr. Gray's conspiracy and provided drugs. Now, there's no allegation, nor could there be, that the drugs that Ms. Webster provided Lionel Nunn went to Mr. Gray, because that occurred prior to his meeting Mr. Gray. There was very little drugs that went the other way after 98. I think there were three or five instances in total, and not particularly large amounts, to the players in this case. There may be larger amounts everywhere else, but in the context of these conspiracies, it was not large amounts. Now, the question is, was that evidence admissible at all? And I will concede that under the federal rules, anything that is somewhat relevant can come in without error being created. The problem is that there are safeguards for evidence that is not part of the conspiracy, what we call other crimes evidence. And his dealings with Ms. Webster clearly are other crimes. The money laundering, clearly other crimes, et cetera. So you then have two distinct types of protection to avoid unfair prejudice. One, the judge recognizes it's 404B material, which never happened here. But had the judge done that, he would then have done a balancing act, 404B versus 403, the prejudice and the probative value. Well, the judge never believed it was 404B, and he therefore never did such an analysis. No.
I asked you about the instruction. There was an instruction given to the jury, correct?
Which one, Your Honor?
Oh, remember I just asked you.
Oh, you're talking about Rayful Edmonds?
No, on the Nunn, too. Wasn't there an instruction that the...
Just to the convictions, just to their pleas of guilty, not to the facts. They didn't just put in, Ms. Webster, you're a convicted felon, yes, what you plead to, and Mr. Nunn pled to this, and you can't count that. They spent days putting on the specific evidence of that conspiracy.
Was there no limiting instruction at all given
on
that evidence?
None. No instruction saying this is being introduced for the limited purpose of.
All right. So that instruction we can ask the prosecutor as well, because I know the district court ruled later that the 404B evidence was direct proof of one or more of the elements that the government had to prove. And he said the creation, the existence, the pattern, the internal associations, the ongoing nature and acts in furtherance of the charged conspiracy. That was his post-trial ruling. So I'm trying to understand what your understanding is of the record.
Well, at the time,
was coming in.
At the time, what the judge said was that he was letting it in because it showed that since Mr. Nunn was a major drug dealer in the mid-90s, he was therefore able, willing, and prepared to become the major drug supplier for Gray. To us, that's pure propensity. That's one of the concerns that we had. And I think that's at
I thought the judge also
page 92
said
of his
judge book. Also said that the connection to Webster helped as a source of supply.
But that may have
that's
been
why it was
what he said. But the evidence is clear that she was his source of supply prior to the time that he even met Mr. Gray. So those drugs that went to Mr. Nunn in the early part of the conspiracy, before he joined or was alleged to have joined the Gray-Moore conspiracy, really are not relevant, other than to show he had the ability to sell drugs in large quantities. And therefore is predisposed to be able to and wanting to fill the role he's being accused of, that is, selling drugs to Mr. Gray. I think my yellow light is on. I'd like to save
some
time.
Your time is almost up.
Can I save some for everybody?
Well, we'll give you back some.
Okay, thanks. And I think the Bowie case is helpful to us because what they really went off on was the theory that this activity was integral to the big picture to tell the story of how the conspiracies, you know, the Moore conspiracy and the Gray conspiracy operated and how Nunn got involved. But really, the big picture is not a good theory, most people say, and Bowie in this circuit says the same. You can find reasons
Your
to get
there. Your time is up now.
Thank you.
I just say we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear from the government.
I wanted to start with factually filling in some of the details about Phyllis Webster's testimony, because I think what's happened here is appellants have focused simply on what she testified to and not other testimony in the case that has a bearing on how her testimony fit.
Can you just tell us, was there a limiting instruction given to the jury before the Edmund, Nunn, Webster, and Lee?
There was not, because it wasn't admitted under 404. It was admitted as intrinsic evidence of the conspiracy itself. So there was no 404 instruction.
Even as to the Edmund testimony?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I will say that I would need to double check that.
Unlike counsel for your opposing parties, I'm rather concerned about the Edmund testimony.
I had asked counsel beforehand, Your Honor, and they had indicated they were only going to argue the Nunn-Webster conspiracy.
Well, so actually control that.
I understand that. I simply want to point out that I may not be able to answer all your questions and may need to provide some more information. But it was all admitted as intrinsic to the conspiracy itself.
Fundamentally, Edmund testified for, 6.5 hours all told or thereabouts?
It was a lengthy period of time
and
at the very beginning.
Virtually, looked like not virtually all, but a substantial majority of it was before this conspiracy was even formed, and he told all kind of horrible details about what was happening in drug dealing in Washington. And I'm having a hard time figuring out. I know it's not 404B evidence because it's a wrong committed by somebody other than the defendant, so I guess it doesn't count as 404B, but I'm not really sure, even under the liberal standards of federal rules, relevance, how that was relevant in the first place, and B, how it survived, how its probity survived balance against prejudice. Can you give me a general statement on that? Now, I understand
I can, Your Honor. As the district court's ruling afterward indicated, one of the things that the government has to prove is that the conspiracy came into existence, mm-hmm. and what its basic structure was, what its goals were, and how it performed. And the Rafael Edmund testimony was admitted directly as to that point. It did show.
The prosecutor argued that what that testimony was going to show was that Moore was schooled by Edmund. He learned the nature of the game. And yet, that's not what the testimony showed. It just showed, you know, he was a lowlife in the Edmund operation, not that Edmund was somehow, you know, his mentor.
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor. I think it didn't directly show that. Edmund didn't testify. I educated Rodney Moore.
But there's an. Told the jury that's why this evidence was coming in.
And the evidence did show that by inference, because there was plenty of information that was provided.
To that extent, 404B, I guess, but.
There was plenty of information that Edmund testified to about the way his conspiracy operated. And
yeah, but there was miles of it that didn't have anything to do with Moore or anybody else who was a defendant in this case.
But it did. It was important to another point as well, which is one of the reasons this conspiracy was able to survive and operate as in the way that it did for so long was because Moore had a connection with Edmund. And there were certainly witnesses that testified to that, that Moore's connection with Edmund, everyone knew about it, and that gave him...
Did anybody make that point in the... Did any attorney make that point?
I believe I made it, Your Honor, in the government's brief.
In the trial court?
Was
that point made that this evidence is being offered to show that they were able to operate safely because they had the cover of...
I'm not suggesting that they had the cover of Rafael Edmund, but just that his connection with Rafael Edmund gave him street credentials, if you will, of a kind that no other dealer had. And there was definitely evidence as to that in the trial. I cannot recall right now whether anyone offered that as an argument, however.
I'm not even sure we heard that evidence exactly. But
this was two consecutive days of hearing, right?
That's correct. At the beginning of what ended up being a 10-month-long trial or 9-month-long trial.
Days. No instruction, and the only thing they had was the government's opening argument. That's all the jury knew.
That's correct, but there was a wealth of evidence that came after. Again,
yeah, you're familiar with the principle of primacy?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Are you familiar with the principle, the memory principle of primacy?
No, Your Honor.
That is that persons, including jurors, maybe especially jurors, remember strongly that which they hear first. Primacy and recency are the two things that are supposed to be strongest on memory.
I think that might be true in a shorter trial, but I'm not sure that would carry on.
It might be truer in a longer trial.
In any event, I think the testimony as a whole, again, if you look at the entire record, there was a lot of what Rafael Edmund did and the way he operated, and Rodney Moore was in a position to see that, was actually behavior that Rodney Moore carried into his own conspiracy with Mr. Gray. Shall I address the Nunn Webster?
Go ahead.
Okay. On the issue of the Nunn Webster conspiracy, as I indicated, again, this is a situation where you have to look at the evidence as in its entirety. Phyllis Webster testified that she sold drugs to Lionel Nunn three or four times in 1997 and 98. On cross-examination, she indicated that the latest she sold drugs would have been October of 98, or certainly she sold them no later than October of 98. These were large quantities. These were not small one-off deals. They were multiple tens of kilos at a time. Lionel Nunn and Kevin Gray met in July of 1998, and the testimony was that Nunn began to serve Gray at that time. There's certainly no evidence that the drugs Nunn got from Webster were the actual drugs Nunn gave to Gray, and we're not saying that. But there's certainly, given the overlap here in timing, given the fact that the Nunn's ability to get very large quantity of drugs enabled him to do business with Kevin Gray, and he wanted to do business with Kevin Gray because he wanted to enlist Gray's help in
murder.
Well,
if it's not the source of supply, though, then it's 404B. It's not part of this conspiracy, yeah. Right?
Well, I don't know that we can say. I think there's certainly an inference that it could have been the source of supply because there's an overlap in time. There's just no direct evidence of that. In terms of whether or not it would otherwise be intrinsic, I still think it can because it's corroborative of what the government's witnesses were saying Nunn's role was. We know that he was a drug dealer. We know that he was...
Just we know he's a drug dealer. That.
No, 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 but he had access to
like
very...
propensity evidence at best, and propensity evidence is inadmissible.
There's so much more to Phyllis Webster's testimony, though. I mean, she is able to, she testified that Nunn knew Carlos Cardoza, and we know that later Carlos Cardoza is the person that Nunn tries to, or has killed through Kevin Gray and through Oscar Veal.
Did you really need her testimony to show that he knew Carlos Cardoza?
No, but it's a piece of it, Your Honor. I mean, it goes to that point. I mean, you know,
wouldn't you be a lot better off right now if there were a 404B instruction and or a 403 weighing of probity against prejudice? I'm a little surprised the government didn't ask for it to protect the record.
Rule 404, though, is this court has repeatedly said, is a rule of inclusion, not exclusion. And it's not.
I know. I've heard that every time the prosecutor.
And this evidence, it was offered for specific reasons. It was not offered to show criminal propensity.
Granted, so, it was offered right. for specific reasons. Why wasn't there an instruction to the jury that told them that?
There was not an instruction because it was not admitted for under a 404 purpose. But I think the lack of an instruction
you're
here.
You're meeting yourself coming back. You just said it was offered for a specific purpose. And if it's only offered for a specific purpose, shouldn't there have been an instruction?
Well, the purpose was to show elements of the conspiracy, Nunn's role in it, and how he was able to carry out that role. But, Your Honor, the lack of if it comes down to the lack of an instruction here, I would say that that error is harmless because there was enough instruction given, even though not an instruction on purpose. There was certainly enough here to cabin the jury's discretion in the way it used this evidence.
What's your best support for that purpose?
Well, the jury was told that none of the other defendants were part of the Nunn-Webster conspiracy. The jury was instructed that the fact that...
How did that help Nunn any?
Well, the jury was instructed specifically with respect to Nunn that, court's indulgence while I find it. You've heard testimony from certain witnesses that they pled, well, this is the RICO conspiracy or drug conspiracy that Phyllis Webster testified she had pled to. You may not infer that because these witnesses pled guilty to a RICO or drug conspiracy that the existence of the RICO or drug conspiracy charged in this case has been proven.
That's from the plea, right? That's
right.
Not
the evidence, but
conduct.
Correct, but the conduct is what led to the plea. I don't know that the jury would have parsed it quite so sharply and said, well, he didn't, no one else engaged in the conduct. And the jury was also instructed, you may not infer from Ms. Webster's plea agreement to the plea of guilty to the drug conspiracy in that case that the government has proven the participation of Mr. Nunn in the conspiracy in that case. So when you take all those pieces together, the jury's told you can't infer Nunn's guilt from her testimony of that case. You can't infer that that case implies guilt in this case. So as a whole, I think it was sufficient to dispel the sort of prejudice that this court would have to find in order to reverse.
Your time is up unless my colleagues wish further questions. So, seeing none, we'll give, he used his time, we'll give him back 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Zwirling?
I think when you look at the Edmonds situation and the Nunn-Webster situation, even if you were to find that one or the other wasn't enough to create unfair prejudice, I think the combination of the two clearly puts it over. I think either one puts it over. But the jury was led to believe that the drugs in the garage of Mr. Nunn was evidence of this conspiracy. The money was evidence of this conspiracy. It was coming in with no limitation saying, no, it's not for this conspiracy, just to show that he, and then give whatever legitimate reason it could come in, if there is one, other than propensity, which clearly is not a reasonable reason. But that never happened.
Of course, even when those instructions are given, you would argue with some justification that jurors have trouble categorizing
right.
it in the way the instruction.
And you would tell me
right.
that I am to presume, and you will presume, that the jurors follow
That's
the
true.
Instructions of the That's court.
True.
The problem is when there is no such instruction,
right.
there is no safe harbor for the court to go to. And that's the problem in this case. It was a put everything in and let's convict these guys mentality in that courtroom. And I'm not saying that in a bad way from the judge's point of view or whatever. I mean, 31 murders, a lot of bad things occurring, people wearing stun belts. You know, it was not, you know, your average case. And there were a lot of pressures. There was death penalty involved. And my position is that that's all the more reason that instruction should have been given and the jury given better guidance, because I don't think in toto there was a fair, unprejudiced atmosphere in that courtroom, and that the evidence that came in was not unfairly prejudicial to our clients, especially without those instructions. I don't think it should come in, period, but if it came in, it had to have both the analysis of probative versus prejudice and the instruction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll move to the next issue. That's you again, okay?
Yes, excuse me. Go ahead. Back again with a fresh clock. Your Honor, this is our concern about Mr. Graham's testimony and whether or not it was improper to have admitted it. We point to the anti-bribery statute, and I know that the cases are legion that the government is allowed to exchange leniency for testimony.
Yeah, they are. The anti-bribery statute has nothing to do with this case, does it, counsel?
But it has.
The cases are legion. That anti-bribery statute has nothing to do with plea bargains.
Well, that's right. But this was not a plea bargain, first of all. This is a gentleman who went to trial, was convicted, filed his appeal. Mm-hmm. He then, after getting 17 and a half years, writes
you
a letter.
You don't seriously contend the anti-bribery statute applies differently on a post-plea bargain than on a pre-plea bargain, do you?
Well, I think it does in this regard. First of all, every case that has looked at this has looked at whether or not the consideration was lawful and has determined that leniency for testimony is lawful under the history of our country, its jurisprudence, and specifically congressional dictates. Our case is different. We submit that if you look at whether or not the stipulation that Mr. Graham couldn't reasonably have seen the value of the information that he had, if you accept that stipulation as truthful, I'll sit down.
The district court so found.
I don't know that he found it.
Well, he found that he noted the failure of prior counsel to inform Graham.
That's different. So that was
Graham's awareness after 1 year when he had new counsel.
Different again. Look at, first of all, he's talking about whether Graham knew he could get value for the information, not whether the information was valuable. 2 weeks after
what?
Whether the information he had was valuable to the government. That's what that language talks about. If you look at this case, when you look at the testimony, get away from the stipulation. The stipulation, we say, is a stipulation that the world is flat. And when you look at the testimony and the record, you'll see the world is round. Within 2 weeks of his arrest, Mr. Heffey, the assistant U.S. attorney and an agent, and Mr. Graham's lawyer, meet in a room, probably in the courthouse. I'm not sure where it was. May have been at the jail. And the government is trying to convince this gentleman to cooperate. Now, in the real world, they're not going there and saying, we want you to cooperate and plead guilty and go to jail for the rest of your life. They're saying, you can get benefit from cooperation. If you assist us, we'll help you and explain Rule 35 and stuff. We asked for a hearing to have the agents and the, this is after the, in our motion for a new trial, to flesh this out, what we think is intuitive. Just in case they failed to mention that they wanted him to testify and it would be in his benefit to testify. Then, and he had a lawyer then, and he never said, the lawyer never said that it was in his, he could get benefit. He said, he didn't tell me I could get as much benefit.
The only difference between this and the cases that say plea bargain is not anti-bribery violations is the timing, right?
Is whether it was a legal.
Is whether there was enough reason to get over the time bar in Rule 35.
Right.
Right?
Whether,
do you know of any case that supports you on that?
Well, I raised it once before in the 11th Circuit, mm-hmm. in a case called Radcliffe. The court, in a footnote, said, we will reserve this for another day because we're reversing on another ground. In the oral argument, one of the judges asked the U.S. attorney whether, oh, isn't that the witness you bribed? Now, of course, that's not by him.
We say a lot of dumb things from the bench, too, at times.
And why shouldn't we quote you on the few occasions that you do? but our position is that this was an illegal gratuity. And if you look at the record, and we've set it out pretty decently, as the type of information he had.
Your time is up, but I will ask you, assuming that it is an illegal gratuity,
right,
is there any case that says that that gives relief to someone else, that is to say, to the defendant in the
well,
case?
Well, I would say that if you look at the Singleton en banc decision in one of the concurring opinions, it does say if it is legal, recognized, it doesn't count. And I would say this goes towards the system.
Your time is up.
All right, thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
Your Honor, we do not believe that the district court erred in denying the new trial premised on the government's cooperation agreement with Steve Graham. That agreement was entered into in good faith. It was all open and above board. Everything about the agreement was made known to the jury during the trial. They were able to assess Mr. Graham's credibility in light of that agreement, and there simply was no error here. If the court has no questions, we'll...
Seeing none, thank you, counsel. We'll move on to the next.
May it please the court, Neil Jaffe, Assistant Federal Public Defender, on behalf of appellants Calvin Smith and John Raynor. The first issue I'd like to address is the conspiracy withdrawal issue, conspiracy withdrawal instruction. After some 12 days of deliberations, the jury asked whether it had a duty to acquit a defendant if it found the defendant left the conspiracy prior to the statute of limitations period. The stipulated evidence in this case showed that Mr. Smith had been continuously incarcerated for some 6 years before the return of the superseding indictment. But the jury could not make a proper decision as to the withdrawal question because the trial judge responded to the jury's question by erroneously instructing it that Smith, rather than the government, had the burden to prove his withdrawal.
Now, that's something on which we've never assigned the burden. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And there are circuits on both sides of the issue.
Very much so, Your Honor. There's a very wide split among the circuits. The trial court had properly instructed the jury that the government was required to...
Can I interrupt you there? On that circuit split, don't all the circuits put the burden of production on the defense? And then the burden, some put the burden of proof on the defense, some put the burden of proof on the government.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's clear that the defense has the burden of at least production of some evidence, sufficient evidence to present a jury question on the question of withdrawal. Here, the trial court did properly instruct the jury that the government had the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that each defendant participated in the conspiracy within the statute of limitations period. So the fact of withdrawal from the conspiracy prior to that period negates that element of participation within the period. And under settled law of the Supreme Court, due process then requires the government to disprove the fact of withdrawal beyond a reasonable doubt once the defense presents evidence to create a jury question.
Yeah. What you just said seems to me to be inconsistent with the now accepted proposition that there are circuits on both sides. If there is a Supreme Court that makes it settled law that the government has the burden, then there shouldn't be splits on the question.
Your Honor, the circuits that go the other way on this find that withdrawal does not negate the element of membership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
however, the facts here are quite different because of the statute of limitations issue. That this is really a combined statute of limitations withdrawal defense, as the Seventh Circuit found in Reed. So some of those courts that have decided this question and have gone the other way have not had to address the question that's before this court where it's a withdrawal defense combined with a statute of limitations defense. Mr. Smith did present evidence of his withdrawal.
So I'm clear, that's the nature of the circuit split? In other words, there is not a circuit split where there's a statute of limitations aspect?
The only case I'm aware of, Your Honor, is that Seventh Circuit case, Reed. And I believe there may be one case from one of the other circuits that go the other way where there was a statute of limitations question.
Is there any indication that the statute of existence or non-existence of the statute of limitations question was essential to the decision of any of the courts on either side of the split?
It was in the Seventh Circuit in Reed, Your Honor.
Right.
Yes.
Is there any indication in the circuits that are on the other side of the split that their decision was influenced by the lack of a statute of limitations defense?
I don't believe there's any discussion.
Really, the question upon which there's a split does not turn on the statute of limitations defense. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The split seems to turn on the question of whether the withdrawal fact negates an element. My position is that there's a stronger argument that it does when there's a statute of limitations combined defense. Because there, the defendant has not participated at all during the period of the statute of limitations. Here, Mr. Smith did present evidence of his withdrawal, both the evidence of his continuous incarceration during the conspiracy period, as well as evidence that he refused an order from one of the leaders of the conspiracy, apparently to murder an inmate with whom he was incarcerated. And the jury note is probably the best evidence that, in fact, there was a jury question on this issue, because the jury had a very serious question as to how it should go about finding whether Mr. Smith's withdrawal was a complete defense. As we argued in the brief, this error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and the constitutional harmless error standard would apply since it's a due process violation. Therefore, the burden's on the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the instructional error did not contribute to the verdict. And given the evidence presented by Mr. Smith as to his withdrawal and the very weak evidence presented by the government to disprove withdrawal, we would say that the government cannot meet that burden. There are no further questions. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the governor.
We do not believe that the trial court or the district court's instruction to the jury on the withdrawal issue was erroneous, and we believe that it accurately placed the burden of demonstrating withdrawal from the conspiracy on the appellants. I would note that
will concede that there are circuits that go the other way.
There are circuits that go the other way. There is, in fact, a division as to who bears the burden. I want to point out here, too, though, because I think this is an important part of the instruction that was given. The district court was actually very careful. He not only gave the instruction placing the burden of withdrawal on the on appellants, but he also recrafted the statute of limitations instruction, because what he said was the original instruction had been the statute of limitation begins to run and it gave the date as to each appellant when they were indicted, from that date backwards 5 years. When he re-instructed the jury, he said, the statute of limitations begins to run either from that date or the date that a defendant withdrew. So he kept them separate issues, which I think negates the argument here that somehow they were combined in a way that negated an element of the offense. I also think this court should not follow Reed, because I think Reed's analysis on the point that conspiracy and with limitations together negates an element of offense, I think that's faulty. I don't think that that's accurate. And I think that's why that whole decision turned on, and why it distinguished from the usual rule that withdrawal is shown by the defendant.
What was your first sentence? I didn't.
In Reed, the court says, when you have statute of limitations combined with withdrawal, it negates an element of the conspiracy. That's why they believe the burden needed to be placed on the government. I believe I think that reasoning is not solid.
And you agree, though, because you said that you agree that the district court's instruction was correct.
In this case, I think
the five-year period.
I think it takes that issue out of it because the court separated statute of limitations and withdrawal in the way it gave its instruction.
I know, but I just need to understand why you think the Seventh Circuit got it wrong. It said the same thing, didn't it? It said there's a statute of limitations and the government has to show that the defendant was part of the conspiracy during the statutory period. And if you don't show that...
I might be wrong. I'd have to go back and look at Reed. I thought the instruction given there was somewhat different than the one that was given here.
Well, my point is you say they got it all wrong, and I want to understand what in their analysis they got wrong. I'm not into
what
the
they
details
said,
of the specific instruction. I just want to understand why their legal analysis
was incorrect. What they said in Reed was that when you have the statute of limitations and withdrawal together, it creates an absolute bar to liability, and therefore it negates an element of the defense.
And that, you're saying that's what the district court's instructions amounted to?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor.
You agree the government has to show that a person, that a defendant, was a member of the conspiracy?
Correct, and we showed
during
that.
During the statutory period.
We have to show that the defendant was a member of the conspiracy.
Smith says he was in jail continuously. All right. You don't deny that, do you?
That's correct.
Okay.
There's a presumption of continuity of a conspiracy, Your Honor. Once
where is the proof that he's in it? That's what I'm trying to find out.
The proof that he's in it is the proof that he entered into the conspiracy. There was plenty of proof that he was a co-conspirator and he undertook acts in connection with the conspiracy.
The superseding indictment came down in November of 2000?
That's correct.
All right. And so you have a five-year period.
And it dates back for each defendant slightly differently.
Hear me out, counsel. Okay. All right. Superseding indictment, November 2000. Go back 5 years. Mr. Smith says he's in jail in 1994, continuously. So how have you proven that he is a member of this conspiracy during the statutory period?
Because the way the law of conspiracy works, once you show that there is a conspiracy, that he entered into that a conspiracy, then there is a presumption of continuity.
All right.
The burden is then on him to show that he withdrew.
He came forward with evidence, he's arguing, that he was in jail continuously, that he turned down an order to murder somebody that was coming from the conspiracy. While he was in jail. And the jury asked a question for the judge. What do we do with this?
There are two separate points here. The first is that he was in jail. And there are plenty of cases. The standard for showing withdrawal is actually very high. You have to show affirmative conduct showing you're terminating your role with the conspiracy.
Incarceration alone.
I don't. Incarceration in combination with other circumstances, which didn't exist here.
Well, the other circumstances he's pointing to is he turned down an instruction from the conspiracy.
Which happened within the limitations period. That was in 1997. So that would have been within the limitations period. And in fact, the fact that the co-conspirator approached him at that time to undertake actions on the part of the conspiracy rebuts the idea that he had withdrawn before that point, if indeed he withdrew at that point. We don't even think, Your Honor, that was enough to show withdrawal, but if the court believed it did, it's within the limitations period.
So your point is that, as I understand, there's nothing wrong with Reed's analysis. The facts just don't fit Reed.
I still disagree that it negates an element of the offense to have
but
those.
But you agree, don't you, that if there was no proof that Smith was ever in the conspiracy, all right, starting back in 88 through 94. So you don't get the presumption of continuous.
Correct.
All right. Then you're into the Reed analysis, and you're just saying that's not this case.
No, Reed's analysis is that there is a presumption of continuity, but when you have withdrawal and limitations together, it cuts it off. And for some reason, they perceive that as negating membership. We don't believe it does. We think it just triggers the statute of limitations at a different point. But in any event, there was simply not evidence here that this all relates obviously to Mr. Smith, that he withdrew outside of the period of the limitations, because all we know is that he was arrested and incarcerated. There was plenty of evidence that he had other contacts during the period, at least up till 1997, involving other conspirators, passed information along to them. And again, as I said, in 1997, certainly Mr. Gray felt comfortable enough with Mr. Smith's role in the conspiracy to approach him about the Raymond Sanders murder. If Mr. Smith's decision at that time not to participate could be considered withdrawal, it's within the statute of limitations period anyway.
Let me ask you, if Reed applies, the burden of going forward is on the defendant and then the burden of proof's on the government.
That's
you
correct.
Acknowledge that they satisfied the burden of going forward of production.
I don't believe they did, because I don't believe that the cases can be read as saying arrest alone is enough. I don't think they had enough to get an instruction here. Had it not been for the fact that the jury asked for a specific instruction on this point, I don't think if it had been asked initially that they would have been entitled to it.
So on that theory, even under Reed, you prevail.
That's correct. If the court has no further...
Well, let me just follow that through so I'm clear. If Smith is the enforcer and he can't enforce anymore...
Well, he's also part of the drug distribution conspiracy.
There's no evidence he's distributing drugs from jail.
Well, I believe there was evidence that he received drugs in jail, but I think that he received money from the conspirators in jail, so he was profiting from the conspiracy in that way. There were times when he passed along information or talked to other people that were supposedly cooperating, so in that way he's protecting the interests of the conspiracy. So arrest alone doesn't necessarily negate participation in the conspiracy. It negates participation in some acts, but not all.
Not enough to raise a jury question. That was what...
It's certainly not affirmative conduct showing that he's disavowed the purposes of the conspiracy and communicated that to his cohorts.
I mean, I'm just trying to understand what a defendant would have to show in these circumstances where everybody who doesn't cooperate kills. So,
well, certainly if he...
Killed, so you keep talking to people. All right, so your point is arrest is not enough, or rather, continuous incarceration is not enough.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. He had 3 or 4 minutes left. 4 minutes left for rebuttal. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe the cases are quite clear that continuous incarceration, is enough alone to raise a jury question. It's not enough to raise a presumption of withdrawal or certainly to show withdrawal as a matter of law, but it's enough to raise a jury question. The Second Circuit has held that, and I believe the Tenth Circuit has held that as well. I don't believe this court has had to address that question. The government's argument that Smith's refusal to kill a fellow... Yes, Your Honor. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to catch up. There's a lot of paper to try to match up with what counselor's saying here.
I'm painfully aware of
that. I don't have anywhere near all of it on the bench, but every now and then I'm looking for something about what you're saying. So I'm sorry if I seem inattentive. I'm just confused.
No, you don't seem inattentive, Your Honor. I thought you were asking a question. My fault. The Smith's refusal to kill a fellow inmate, his refusal to follow the orders of one of the leaders of the conspiracy, it's unclear from the record exactly when that occurred. Smith had a conversation with...
'95, right?
The conversation with the fellow inmate occurred in '97.
Yeah.
It's unclear exactly when Smith refused the order, or when the order was given, or when Smith refused it. He only told this other inmate about it in '97.
What about the other evidence that the prosecutor pointed to?
The other evidence, Your Honor, is extremely minimal. He did have some contacts with his co-conspirators, but placed in context, these were people that Smith had known for years since he was a juvenile. They did send him a little bit of money. I think it was about $200 over a period of some 6 years. And some question about whether someone was going to send him some marijuana. But no evidence that he participated in the activities of the conspiracy during his incarceration. And when you read the cases where someone is found to continue in the conspiracy after incarceration, there's always evidence that that person somehow remained involved in the conspiracy, continued to arrange drug dealing, ordered hits on people from the outside, something that would tie him into the conspiracy. Here we don't have any of that evidence. I would also point out I agree with the government that there's a presumption of continuity.
Yeah, and I was thinking as you're arguing that about incarceration, why would that presumption not continue to apply? I mean, the fact that he is physically or geographically prevented from physically furthering the conspiracy doesn't seem to me that can defeat a presumption of continuity.
I don't believe it defeats it on its own, Your Honor. I believe it does create a jury question.
It's like a partnership.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Conspiracy is like a partnership.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if you get sick and can't practice law for a while, you don't automatically leave the partnership.
That's true, Your Honor.
If you go to jail, you might, but if you're unable to participate, it doesn't constitute withdrawal.
Well, courts have held that incarceration...
Coupled with nothing else, I'm not suggesting that isn't at least evidence that you could use, but... You seem now to be saying that absent other evidence, it would be conclusive. And I would think the presumption would be the other way.
I don't mean to argue that, okay. Your Honor. It is a factor for the jury to consider, and obviously the jury here did have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So there was sufficient evidence presented as to Smith's withdrawal because the jury was wondering how they should go about determining it.
Mm-hmm.
If there are no further questions, I can move on to my next point, which involves another instruction, and that's the aiding and abetting.
Okay, now we're starting your next argument.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We need to let the make clear to the clerk so she can start the time clocks properly.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Moving ahead too quickly.
You can't move ahead too quickly. That's fine.
The government charged Mr. Smith with two murders and Mr. Rayner with three murders, all under an aiding and abetting theory of liability. The court gave the jury an aiding and abetting instruction that permitted it to convict if it found that the murders were the natural and probable consequence of the defendant's participation in the crimes. The instruction did not require the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendants, the aiders and abettors, had a specific intent to kill. Now, the government concedes that instruction was obviously erroneous as to the murders under the D.C. Code, given the law from the D.C. Court of Appeals on that question. Wilson Bay.
What is the concession that you say they have made?
That instruction, the aiding and abetting instruction, was error.
Okay.
As to the D.C.
Code
murders.
Code violation. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not sure I understood properly.
Our position, as argued in the briefs, is that the instruction was also error as to the murders under federal law in light of this court's decision in United States versus Wilson, which was written by Judge Rogers. And in that case, the court required the government to, in the context of aider and abettor charged with murder, the court required the government to prove that the aider and abettor had shared intent with the principal, that is, that he had the specific intent to kill. Since the natural and probable consequence language is essentially a foreseeability test, it waters down the heightened level of intent required for murder. So as argued in the briefs, our position is that instruction was plain under this court's decision in Wilson, and therefore was plain as to both the D.C. Code murders as well as the federal murders. The defendants, of course, under the plain error standard, and there was no objection, unfortunately, to the aiding and abetting instruction, under the plain error test, the defendants have the burden to show a reasonable probability that they would not have been convicted of these murders absent the erroneous aiding and abetting instruction. And I won't go through the facts of all these murders, but they are argued at some length in the briefs.
Doesn't the Pinkerton instruction, as the D.C. court itself has subsequently held, make that conclusion difficult to reach?
Your Honor, in those cases in which the D.C. Court of Appeals has upheld murder convictions where there's been an erroneous aiding and abetting instruction, there was also a charge of conspiracy to murder in those cases, and the jury convicted on that count as well, so the Court of Appeals was comfortable in finding that the jury found the defendants had a heightened level or a specific intent to kill. Here there was no such charge, and I was unable to find a case in which Pinkerton was applied to sustain a first-degree or intentional murder conviction.
I understand that there is a lot of language that says death is different, but this is, aren't there lots of Pinkerton cases that say that a conspirator is liable for crimes committed in furtherance of the conspiracy?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, they may not be murder, but I don't really understand why that would be any different.
The murder is different, Your Honor, because it requires a heightened standard of intent.
Under the D.C. instruction.
Under the D.C. instruction and under United States versus Wilson in this court. Pinkerton is also a foreseeability test. So it is somewhat analogous to the natural and probable consequence language in the aiding and abetting instruction we're challenging. And therefore, it's not sufficient in a first-degree murder case to sustain a conviction where there's been an erroneous aiding and abetting instruction.
Murders here were charged as overt acts. I realize that's a distinction from D.C. cases, but
That is correct. Okay. I have 20 seconds left, or I'll just retain that for my
Okay. We'll give you back some for
rebuttal. Can I just ask a quick question while you're up?
Come on back.
Sorry, Judge.
The murders are charged as overt acts, and perhaps the prosecutor will address this. I thought the argument, though, is that these were foreseeable as part of the conspiracy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you say the fact that one of the principal purposes of the conspiracy was murder is not enough, and then you distinguish these overt acts on the grounds that they weren't in furtherance of the conspiracy.
Yes, sure.
But the government's theory and case is based on a different premise, isn't it?
We would argue, Your Honor, that foreseeability is not sufficient in the context of first-degree murder.
Period.
I realize I can ask Judge Rogers this later, but what is the case you're giving us from this?
United States versus Wilson.
You got too many Wilsons around. That's also
Wilson,
the name of the D.C.
Wilson Bay is the D.C. Court of Appeals case, and U.S. v. Wilson is from this.
You have that citation handy. I'm looking at the wrong Wilson, so it's not helping me any.
160 Fed 3rd 732.
The brilliant opinion, Your Honor.
I'm sure it was. Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
We believe that the Pinkerton theory here was sufficient. A sufficient vehicle for the jurors to find guilt, and that all the prerequisites for finding Pinkerton liability were satisfied when you look at the jury's verdicts as a whole. First of all, the juries found the appellants guilty of RICO conspiracy, and the RICO conspiracy itself was defined as including, as part of the enterprise, the not just the sale of narcotics, but also the commissions of murders for various purposes. Each of the jurors also found that each of the substantive murders here, the victims here, were their murders constituted racketeering acts. Each of them, several of the murders were found to also be murders in aid of racketeering activity. One of the murders was also found to be a murder in furtherance of the CCE enterprise. So we know that under Pinkerton, you must show a charged conspiracy, the defendant was a member of it, the acts were within the scope of the conspiracy, they were done in furtherance of, and they were reasonably foreseeable. The first four elements of Pinkerton are satisfied by the findings that these individuals were part of the RICO conspiracy, these murders were racketeering acts, and they were convicted of racketeering murder or CCE murder. On the last point, the reasonable foreseeability, both aiding and abetting liability and Pinkerton liability have as an element reasonable foreseeability. So if appellants are correct that the jury somehow went off on an aiding and abetting theory here without intent, they would necessarily have found the last factor, which is reasonable foreseeability, and therefore would have satisfied all the prerequisites to Pinkerton liability as well. And as such, the convictions would stand on the Pinkerton theory.
All right. What do you say to the Wilson case in this Circuit Wilson, not the District Wilson that...
On the issue of whether the error here was...
Whether there has to be a heightened standard of intent for first degree, for murder as a crime in furtherance of the conspiracy under Pinkerton, or whether the usual standard of foreseeability is sufficient.
I think the usual standard is sufficient, but if the heightened standard applies, I think it's met here because when you amalgamate all the jury's findings and the fact that there's racketeering murder here, CCE murder here, it's more than just your simple murder.
Do you think that Wilson, in fact, does create a heightened standard, or is it simply specific to its facts?
I don't think it clearly held that as a general principle.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? If not, did he have time left? Pardon? Okay, you got 2 minutes for rebuttal if you need it.
I don't have anything else to add, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll move on to the severance motions argument, I guess, is next.
Your Honors, Charles Murray, I'm on behalf of Timothy Handy, Jr., and also Mr. Nunn. Your Honor, there's Nunn and Handy offered several reasons why supporting their request for a severance. The 158-count indictment was based around charges of drug conspiracy, count one, and RICO conspiracy count two. Nunn was only charged in 13 counts. Handy, I believe, less, and it was in the mid-90s. Supposedly, Handy was joined the conspiracy. The marked disparity between Handy and Nunn as compared with the others was also true of the murder allegations. The indictment charged 31 homicides, 13 of which took place between May of 89 and August of 94, and seven occurred in 96. The two that Handy allegedly committed occurred in 97. Nunn also is alleged to have been involved in two that occurred in 98 and 99. Now, the glaring disparity in evidence on the face of the indictment, as well as how the actual trial played out, Nunn and Handy found themselves shoehorned between, for almost 9 months, evidence of 29 unrelated murders and testimony regarding co-defendants' conduct that occurred years prior to Nunn and Handy's even knowing them. Now, Richard Simmons' counts should have been severed. Handy argued that Richard Simmons' murder charges should be severed in the first trial since the government intended to try Kenneth Simmons, the alleged mastermind behind this murder, for trial on that murder. Similarly, the government had not yet disclosed who shot Simmons, so it was unknown whether the alleged principal or aider and abettor would be tried first. So that Simmons thing should have been severed. The prosecution's allusions to wiretaps in justifying the putting Handy in the first group, they made sham allusions to wiretaps to peg Handy into the first trial. They represented that there were 9,000 wiretaps covering Group 1 defendants. There were no wiretaps on which Handy was captured. As a practical matter, the judge arranged cases for trial that made it impossible for Handy and Nunn to avoid the likelihood of guilt by association. The spillover was unavoidable. Now, I've cited in my portion of the brief several cases that talk about complex multi-defendant conspiracy cases present a heightened risk of diverting juries from making a reliable judgment about guilt or innocence. And I cited the U.S. Supreme Court case of Safaro versus U.S. Now, also, I'm sorry?
That doesn't help you, that case.
That case doesn't help me?
The court is very clear if the instructions are correct. That's sort of the end of it on severance.
Well,
go beyond Zafara.
I think U.S. versus Long helped me. In such situations, the jury may not be able to compartmentalize the evidence, and the spillover may jeopardize a lesser defendant's right to a fair trial. The accumulation of evidence against all defendants may lead the jury to be either confused or prejudiced in assessing the evidence against the particular defendant. That's U.S. versus Butler, and that's the D.C. Circuit, 1987.
Did we reverse in that case?
No. Trying Handy and Nunn with first group subjected them to spillover effects of evidence of violence that allegedly occurred years before either of them allegedly joined the conspiracies. What we're talking about here is we're talking about fundamental fairness. You know, I would venture to guess I could take any one of you three and put them and shoehorn them in between the people who tried here facing death sentence, and you're going to come out guilty also. The problem that you have here is a genuine spillover effect. In 40 years of doing this, I've never seen so many murder things tried at one time. And here you have an allegation, two guys,
your
one guy is only...
Time is actually up. You'll need to finish up, counsel.
Okay. And so what I'm trying to say is, it, especially since they already had a second case that involved non-death sentence people, they both should have been put into there.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Pardon me?
We'll hear from the government.
Thank you. The district court did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Nunn's and Mr. Handy's motions to sever here. Neither the fact that they were tried alongside death-qualified defendants nor their claim of prejudicial spillover evidence here was sufficient to show the kind of prejudice that would require a severance. This court has indicated, as other courts have indicated, that the type of spillover prejudice you'd have to show, if there's substantial and independent evidence of each individual's involvement in the conspiracy and proper instructions are given, that's usually sufficient to cure any prejudice. And spillover prejudice usually applies where one person's role is de minimis as opposed to others. Certainly Mr. Handy and Mr. Nunn, who were both charged not only with participation in the same conspiracy that all of these appellants were charged in, but were also independently charged with multiple substantive counts of murder, one cannot say that their role was de minimis in any way.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Now, are you rising to rebut or rising for the next issue?
I believe I have rebuttal time left.
You don't have any left. We'll give you 1 minute if you want it for rebuttal. Counsel didn't talk long, so we'll give you only 1 minute for rebuttal. At the end of that, then, I think you're the next speaker on the next issue. First rebut.
Your Honor, we would rebut that by saying that the rules that she has stated generally are true. There are exceptions, and this case is exceptional. You have this conspiracy started back when these gentlemen were juveniles. The fact of the matter is the evidence against them is extraordinarily weak. They deserve to have either their own trials or to be in the second group. It's not like there wasn't a second group already available. It was an abuse of discretion to put these two in the first group.
You don't need to sit down. You can just swing into your next argument, and he has 5 minutes for that, so start the clock over, please, ma'am.
Your Honor, the district court erred when it denied Handy's new trial motions. The fact of the matter is that Handy sought a bill of particulars and to compel discovery as to when he became and with whom he agreed to become involved in the conspiracy. Now, the fact of the matter is in letters February 15, 2001 and May 17, 2001, the government stated expected to present evidence that Handy was a member of the narcotics and RICO conspiracies and involved in the distribution of illegal drugs for some time prior to June 30th, 1997. It further stated much of the proof in the case will be based on testimony of witnesses. Now, the fact of the matter is, it never advised Handy when and with whom he agreed to join the inchoate crimes. On August 5th, Phillips moved, Scorpio Phillips was subpoenaed to testify. Phillips moved to quash the subpoena and asserted his Fifth Amendment privilege not to testify. Now, Phillips claimed that he otherwise would subject himself to a charge of perjury because the trial testimony would be inconsistent with his superior court and federal grand jury testimony about seeing Handy murder Green. In other words, he didn't want to be held for perjury. FBI agent Sparks testified the real basis for Phillips' motion was that Phillips was reluctant to testify. Now, trial judge blocked Handy from cross-examining Sparks regarding Phillips' concessions in his motion to quash the government subpoena. The district court also refused to take judicial notice of the claims made in Phillips' motion. Hence, the jury was never told of Phillips' concession of exposure to perjury charges, but was given the unfounded inference that Phillips feared for his life. And this unfairly buttressed the government's witnesses. Now, the Brady violations, the Handy moved for a new trial based on Brady claims. He claimed prejudice from undisclosed statements of Cheryl Pinkert. Now, they suppressed all those statements from Cheryl Pinkert. Cheryl Pinkert was the actual witness to the Simmons murder. Who did they put on the stand?
Not the only one.
The primary one. The primary one was that they used at trial was Mrs. Simmons,
right.
And Pinkert said that she was not in a position to even see it, and her testimony absolutely flew in the face. Additionally, Mrs. Simmons' testimony was not supported by the ballistics. She testified that he came up and shot him in the chest. None of the ballistics test, none of the scientific evidence supported her. Pinkert, and they knew about Pinkert, they suppressed her knowledge. Now, they could have used her to impeach big time.
They suppressed what?
They suppressed Pinkert's. Pinkert testified at the grand jury.
Yeah.
Pinkert testified at the second trial, but they didn't even acknowledge that she existed in the first trial. And so they could have used her as a rebuttal witness to impeach Mrs.
Simmons.
They didn't
use her, but that's. The verb suppress is more help to you on Brady than simply not using.
They suppressed.
What did they do that constituted suppressing? I will be honest, I have a little trouble following exactly what happened in this part of the case. And I'm not pressing you for the purposes of purifying your argument. I'm partly trying to find out precisely what occurred here.
Okay, what occurred is defense counsel asked for a bill of particulars, put in a motion to find out exactly when all of this happened and all of the information that they could get, and he kept doing that, and he never got any information concerning Cheryl Pinkert. Mrs. Simmons, the mother of the deceased Simmons, testified at trial, and she could have been impeached big time because nothing that she said lined up with either the ballistics or anything else. So they were denied that.
Did the defense have the ballistics information?
My understanding is that they did.
The Brady that you're wanting is all contained in the statement of Sharon Pinkert, whatever her name is.
Cheryl Pinkert.
Cheryl Pinkert, yeah.
Right.
That's the Brady you're talking about.
That's the Brady I'm talking about in that particular case. Now, there was, they also had testimony from Maurice Lili Andrews, and it looks like I only have 30 seconds left.
Go ahead, since you're responding to my question, I'll give you a little longer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think you're actually 30 seconds over rather than have left, but take another couple of minutes.
The contrary to what the prosecutors promised, they did not have corroborated testimony from unindicted co-conspirator Maurice Lili Andrews. Maurice Lili Andrews testified three different times. Two times, he said Handy was not there when they went to look for Baskerville. Two times, once before and once after.
Instead of just weighing evidence, is there something about him that they withheld that was Brady?
Yes, they withheld his prior statements. His prior statements to the grand jury that Handy was not involved.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Now, I will call time on you, and if needed, we'll give you back some additional rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let us hear from the government.
With respect to the first point counsel raised regarding Scorpio Phillips, that issue was not fleshed out in appellant's argument in his brief. We believe that was abandoned. In any event, there's no merit to that. The testimony about Scorpio Phillips that he claims he should have been permitted to rebut was actually elicited by defense counsel in cross-examination of Officer Sparks, and I think the court simply terminated it because it was getting too far afield of anything relevant because Phillips was not a witness in the trial. With regard to Cheryl Pinkard, everything about Cheryl Pinkard was known to appellant during the first trial. They cross-examined Mrs. Simmons with information about Cheryl Pinkard, asked her if she was there, if she saw things. So there was nothing that was withheld. There was even evidence turned over regarding a statement Cheryl Pinkard had made to a woman named Letitia Dwyer. Defense counsel knew about that during the first trial. There was no Brady withheld here. Similarly, with respect...
You're going too fast for me.
Sorry, Your Honor.
This is not a retrial situation, is it?
No. There's the second trial. I'm sorry, the Group 2 defendants trial.
Right. That's all before us, is the first trial.
First trial.
Okay.
Right, the Group 1 defendants.
So, at the first trial, you say on cross-examination by defense counsel...
He asked questions.
Sparks talked about Cheryl Pinkard.
No, I'm sorry. I did go too fast, Your Honor. Agent Sparks relates to the first individual, Scorpio Phillips.
All right, and the judge cut it off because we were going too far afield.
Yeah.
Is that what you
said?
No, I'm just trying to understand what you said.
Yeah. Mr. Lastly, I believe it was, asked questions.
So I didn't ask you any...
I'm sorry, wait.
I didn't ask you any questions about that because you said the argument wasn't fleshed out in the brief, so it's abandoned.
Right.
But now we're talking about Cheryl Pinkard.
Correct.
Now, did the defense know of her statements?
Yes, and they...
And when did they learn of them?
I don't know exactly when they learned of them, but they did before trial because...
They used it in cross-examination of Mrs. Simmons.
Of Mrs. Simmons.
Right.
All right.
And that's the Brady argument, is that it should have been available on the credibility of Simmons.
Correct. Right? And it was available.
He did question Simmons about Pinkard.
About Pinkard. And moreover,
I thought there was grand jury testimony that was not made available.
Yeah.
That grand jury.
We are having some trouble understanding what occurred here.
Right. I'm not sure when. I believe that grand jury testimony was turned over in connection with the second trial. But they certainly knew.
What happened in the second trial doesn't help you.
Right.
That's no help to you.
But
what we want to know is, were you. Not you personally, we understand that, but was the United States in possession of that Pinkard grand jury testimony and didn't turn it over to the defense?
There was nothing about the Pinkard grand jury testimony that was material exculpatory information because there's nothing about it that's exculpatory.
They are claiming and making an argument that it was impeaching of the Simmons testimony, that what Pinkard had to say at the grand jury was inconsistent with your witness, Simmons.
It's only inconsistent, Your Honor, if you focus on one specific statement Pinkard made out of context.
They get to do that. I'm very bothered by the notion that you make the decision for them whether that's material.
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm trying to say. The statement is taken out of context is what I'm trying to say. Pinkard was on the phone, was not watching at the moment of the shooting. And so
they can't all go to the weight of it if Pinkard is considered as a witness. But as far as whether they're entitled to have that testimony, I don't know why that matters at all.
Because it's not material and exculpatory. It's simply not material exculpatory.
How is the court going to decide it? The materiality part of Brady, in my view, and I think many people's view, is put in there for the post hoc examination the court's going to make. But in determining whether you're going to turn material or turn information over to the defense, for the prosecutor to say, well, that's immaterial, who the blank are you to say it's immaterial? They're the ones that have the duty of defending. We're the ones that have the duty of deciding if you violated. And for you to decide that that one statement is not material and therefore you didn't have to turn it over is... chutzpah may be too strong a word, but it may not. I'm not accusing you personally of it, but the government's failure to turn over ought to have some better reason than simply that, well, it was just a little bit of it that was exculpatory.
Your Honor, I don't even believe it was impeaching. As I'm trying to point out, I believe that the appellant's entire argument to claim it was impeaching rests on taking it out of context. When you read her testimony as a whole, it's not impeaching of Margarita Simmons at all. In fact, it's corroborative.
We can use that to say that it was harmless for the government to withhold it, but I can't for the life of me see why the government didn't turn that over. You knew you had grand jury testimony on somebody that you admit that they were cross-examining based on this person, Pinkard, and you never did give them, I'm not talking about you personally, I understand, but the government never did give them that grand jury testimony even after they have cross-examined.
But Pinkard was not a witness, and there was nothing, in our view, there's nothing about that evidence that's impeaching. It's corroborative.
I understand your view has very little to do with what a defense attorney wants.
I understand.
You don't get to pick their defense. You don't get to pick their
defense. But we have to have some basis for believing that the evidence meets the standards under Brady, and there's no evidence for...
And they had questioned the witness, cross-examined Ms. Simmons, and suggested the inconsistency with Pinkard. Is that correct? Am I understanding you correctly?
I'm not sure they suggested the inconsistency. I think, quite frankly, Your Honor, I don't remember exactly what they asked about Pinkard, but her name came up during Margarita Simmons' testimony.
You're the one who told me her name came up. You're the one who told me they knew about Pinkard.
Right.
You're the one who told me her name came
up.
But
the fact that they knew about her doesn't make it.
And for you now to back away and say, well, we didn't have any reason to know that that was Brady is not.
It's not Brady simply because they know there's another witness. There's nothing about what we knew about the witness that would lead us to believe that anything she had to say was material or exculpatory or really even impeaching when you view her comments in context. In fact, she corroborated. Their whole argument here.
Coming back to that, when you view it in context.
Because she.
They should have the right to make that determination, shouldn't they? If they're the ones defending and there's evidence out there on this murder. And the government has it.
I cannot for the life of me see why this wasn't turned. I disagree, Your Honor. I think if there's no reason to think that the evidence is impeaching, it's just not impeaching. And you can pull one word out of a sentence.
If the government doesn't see the impeaching nature of it, you're going to prevent the defense from attempting to.
But there is no impeaching nature to this testimony.
You told
That's
me a while ago one sentence taken out of context was impeaching.
I said if you take one statement out of context, that's what they're arguing was impeaching. But when you view the evidence as a whole, Cheryl Pinkard did not say she was watching the scene as it unfolded, every aspect of it. She was on the telephone, and she was her attention was on the call she was making.
All
she
that
corroborated.
Is good on the weight of the evidence.
Well, on that.
Real good, but you.
Let's turn to that, Your Honor.
I do not. Understand the attitude of the United States in not turning over evidence like that is brief.
Well, certainly, as Your Honor has pointed out, if the court feels that we should have turned it over, it's certainly harmless here.
We may now be able to determine it's not material or it's harmless, but the idea that the government weighs materiality in deciding whether to turn something over is frankly offensive. Post hoc, we can look at materiality, but who are you to determine what's material to the defense?
If it's, Your Honor, I think we just disagree. If it's not exculpatory or and we don't have any reason to believe it's impeaching, then I don't know how we could possibly determine that it should be turned over. But in any event...
A good time might have been when they were asking about Pincard in cross-examination if you hadn't realized it before. But you now have an idea why you should have known.
But certainly, as Your Honor indicated, it would be harmless because this is simply not material
Maybe.
Information.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Your Honor, on August 20th, 2002, Handy again requested Brady information on Simmons' murder from the crime scene officer Kenley and all statements of the eyewitnesses, especially from Pinkert. The government responded, all the janks for all the witnesses have been produced. All Brady has been produced. The government did not disclose the October 27th, 2000 FBI statement of Pinkert, nor did it provide Pinkert's critical grand jury testimony.
The FBI statement is a whole other issue that we are a little late in the day getting to as to whether the 302.
Okay. It did not disclose whether Pinkert was shown photo arrays that included Handley or other suspects. Now, in six different instances, she was an eyewitness and says that Margarita Simmons was not on direct and at cross-examination. She was asked specific questions. Question, did you see him, Richard Simmons, leave from the store, walk down the steps, and go over to the telephone? Yes, I just told you that. I told you I saw him come out of the store and go over to the phone booth. Question, did you see him on the telephone? Yes. Did you see his mother standing right there, or
did you
miss her?
You're referring this to cross-examination.
I'm sorry?
You referred to this as cross-examination?
No.
There's no cross-examination at a grand jury. I thought you said cross-examination.
I hope I didn't.
Maybe I misunderstood you.
I beg your pardon.
Okay.
Did you see his mother standing right there, or did you miss her? She wasn't there. She was not there? No. She was not at his side when he was on the telephone? No. Are you absolutely sure? I'm positive. We didn't get those statements. We didn't get the FBI statement. We didn't get the grand jury statement. It would have made a big difference in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I will pause a moment because of the unusual nature of this case and ask if either of my colleagues has any questions on the issues argued or unargued before we deprive ourselves of the opportunity. Seeing none, then you may give us recess.
Are we supposed to clean off our table?
No, I need that.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.